Failsafe, guidance for resilient cloud architectures, developed by Microsoft Services and the Azure Customer Advisory Team.
All right, designing for manageability. This is the last piece of the triangle. If you don't know what your system is doing, it is neither scalable nor available, or maybe it is, you just don't know. And getting insight into a running system at scale, a running service at scale, requires a new set of muscles and a new set of approaches. And we'll kind of dive into both kind of some of the things you need to think about, how you build a mental model, how you build a physical model, what you measure, what you analyze, and what you react to, as well as the implementation options you have, both for role your own, as well as for incorporating third-party services that are great Azure partners. So really, the limit of scale, the limit of availability, is the limit of insight. You want to know what your SLA is, what your response time, what the user experience is before your users do and call you up and say, hey, you're busted. Or better yet, they go onto Twitter and say, hey, they're busted. Social media brings wonderful new time frames and latencies to the ability to get inside of a user's satisfaction loop with your service. This is not stuff we had to worry about 10 years ago. And the kind of the second piece when we talk about ALM, we could spend an entire day just talking about ALM approaches. For me, it's the most boring thing on the planet. I can't stand it. But it's also unbelievably important. It is probably one of the most important things we could talk about, because no amount of design, no amount of proper architecture prevents you from taking a bad piece of code and pushing it live and watching it explode. The human factor still predominates. One thing we'll come back to is we've gotten used to treating code as something that's big and heavy and blocky and here be dragons and just don't touch it. And configuration is something we can just go in and tweak and change. In a large-scale production service, configuration is code. You have an atomic unit. Your code is useless without config. Config does not run without code. And almost every massive outage I've seen, said a couple times today, has been related to a bad configuration getting pushed out. So we'll talk about a few approaches for managing config. All right, so who's played Frogger? Age check. Okay. This is what the experience would like of running a live service. We have global visibility. We see problems coming before they get there, and we can get out of the way. We cannot get run down by the trucks or drown in the river. However, the reality for sites is not this. When you're having discussions with customers, how often does manageability, monitoring, telemetry, instrumentation get pushed as, we'll do that when we need to? Come on, I know everyone's had that discussion. So here's the reality of most live site operations. I can see you're in front of me. I don't know what has happened. I don't know what is happening. And I have no idea what is about to happen. But I will boldly go forth into the river or in front of the semi. Not a good experience, especially running a production service. We can't operate systems like this anymore. And the good news is we have a pretty good handle on approaches and techniques, some canned, some with a little bit more custom, a little bit more dev, that can get us into a world where we see and understand more. The other key thing here is it used to be that everything that mattered to providing a good experience to my users was up to me. They were my enterprise users. They all worked for my company. I provided their computers, their network, their hardware, their services. Captive audience, captive systems. As soon as I go out to internet-facing services, so many other things start to happen.
And known capacity.
Yes, known capacity, not dynamic capacity. If I have 100,000 employees, I need to be able to monitor for 100,000. If I'm providing video for March Madness or the Super Bowl or the Olympics, all of a sudden, I have no idea how many people will show up, other than that it will be a very big number. So let's kind of go into a little bit of philosophy about how we need to think about this thing. Instrumentation. Who's really good at putting tracing information in all their code? I will freely admit, even though I believe wholeheartedly in this, I still don't do as much of this as I want to. If you do not instrument it, if you do not capture it, if you do not analyze it, it did not happen. If you didn't measure it, that whole observational thing, it's not real. And this is something that we've been taught for a long time of, you can't instrument production systems. You'll slow them down. You'll crush them. And if you do it incorrectly, that's absolutely right. What we'll talk about are approaches to being able to do rich instrumentation in production systems without dropping the box, without spending more work on observation than on the stuff you're getting paid for. It's a little tricky, but we can talk about how to do it. But that's really, I had a lot of discussions with folks going, well, we just turn off all of our logging in production. Okay, turning off all logging in production. This is turning off all logging in production. Who has different log levels or has seen customers with different log levels between test and prod? That's everybody. What are we saying? We're saying that we have a different diagnostic solution for production. We have a different workflow. We have different ways. My hypothesis that I will throw to you is if you cannot diagnose your production service, not your server or your system, but your service from logs, you cannot diagnose it. In a world where I have 50 web servers and one database server, insight is easy. I log into the database server and I start combing through DMVs. It's all there in one place. If I have 1,000 web instances and a remote desktop client, I'm either billing out at a fantastic rate with an unhappy customer, or I'm in a lot of trouble. I have to automate these things. I have to collect. I have to centralize. The remote desktop plus WinDBG is what happens after I've localized, after I've isolated, after I've narrowed down the scope of a problem, which is based on collection, instrumentation, collection, and analysis of telemetry. Inter-service monitoring. My application is not an island. It depends on many things. We see these recurring themes all coupled together. If I don't capture information about all of my inter-service dependencies and my inter-service calls, I can't diagnose them. Remember earlier when we were talking about that huge latency spike caused by a failing dependent service? The only telemetry we had at the time was the IIS application log, and there was no rhyme or reason. There was no one service that was backed up because every service was queuing up behind the failing services. We had to use psychic debugging in order to figure out what was going on there. And I do not recommend psychic debugging if you have an SLA to maintain. It's a little hit or miss. In that case, we actually hit, but it took 4 hours. So what we absolutely need this ability to go service A called service B called service C. Once I move to billing device applications, this becomes even more important because my device needs to be able to report as part of a workflow that pulled from this service and this service and this service. Here was my failure. Can you trace this back? Many Azure services give you a tracing ID, a GUID that says, here's the activity this was related to. If you think about that, there's a huge amount of infrastructure that goes on behind the scenes to associate that activity ID with all the steps in a distributed system. As we move to, purely asynchronous code, I can't use the thread ID anymore because I'm bouncing between threads. So we need to look at this problem in a slightly different way, but we must have this information. The other part is about runtime configurable logging. Who's used TraceSource? System.diagnostics.trace? Everybody has, I know. Some people just don't want to admit it. I freely admit that I use System.diagnostics.trace for a long time, but I'm better now. So here's one of the reasons, here's one of the challenges with the core .NET diagnostics experience in Azure. They're hard-coded, they're .NET 1.0 APIs, and they're hard-coded to pull their configuration from system.configuration. System.configuration looks to app-config or web-config for its sources. If I control the box, no big deal. I use web-deploy or some other tool to update those files. In Azure, in an Azure cloud service, those files are part of my immutable deployment package. I can't change them anymore unless I physically log into the box and start editing files. That's kind of a no-no. So all of a sudden, if I'm using TraceSource, my configuration is immutable. It can't be modified. Plus, it's pretty hard to work with, and it's a purely unstructured logging surface. We'll get to why that can be bad in a second. So we need something that lets us do runtime configurable logging. So I always break this problem down in three steps. There's actually a fourth one, which is around instrumentation, but I'll bundle that together with collection for now. I need to say, what information do I produce? What information do my developers need to go in and actively instrument? Now, I want to keep this as low as possible because I want to spend time solving business problems, not building plumbing. But a certain amount of this can be necessary. But where possible, I want to wrap this up in the facades, wrap this up in the access layers. So that if I call down to a database, I as a developer, I don't have to worry about logging that. It just happens. I showed a little bit of a snippet of that earlier, and we can go back in time and dive into some of the details. I need to deliver my events to some form of analytics service that coalesces all the data and produces insight from data. Data and information, not the same thing, especially if I have a lot of events that don't mean anything individually. And I need to receive and store many live streams of data, because I need to capture feeds from all of my instances, I need to capture feeds from my services, and I may even need to capture feeds from my devices, depending on how rich my application is. But again, we only do this because we want to answer questions, and then we want to react. We either want to inform or we want to act. In terms of analyze, I need to look at, if I have a 3-second SLA, well, I'd better be looking at data more often than every 5 minutes, because I cannot adhere to my SLA if I cannot monitor within the bounds of my SLA. So if I have relatively stringent SLAs, I either need real-time monitoring or a really good refund department. I recommend both. I need to look at aggregations, pivots, and patterns. Basic KPIs, they're usually just aggregations. Take a value, look at a time window, roll it up, create an aggregate. If I'm looking at something a little bit more sophisticated, like outlier detection, is a particular API operating within its statistical boundary? This is a lot more complicated. It's the same question of, here's a bunch of data, does this make sense? Rather than creating an average, I may need to look at a historical average by time of day and say, is this value more than 2 standard deviations out of sync? Again, the same basic foundation, we just apply more advanced analytics. I would use the term machine learning, but it's horrifically overloaded, so we won't go there. Finally, I need to consume, and everything else is just to get to the point where I either inform or influence. Is the site up and running? How many users are here? What's going on? Do I feel good about this service? Versus, I need to take an automated action to add capacity, to trigger a circuit breaker, to shift load to a different code path. This happens at many different levels. Ultimately, it's about making better decisions and making data-driven decisions. Who's ever heard a customer say, hey, this thing feels slow? I see the laughs. We've all been there. And to a certain extent, yeah, some stuff can feel slow. Happily, we have the tools, we have the techniques where we can now make data-driven decisions going, okay, no, really, this last change, we had a 2x regression. Things that used to take 100 milliseconds now take 200. I don't think anyone really noticed that. Or things that used to take 500 milliseconds now take 7 seconds. Now, okay, that's a problem. Let's focus our efforts here. We need to make data-driven optimizations, not intuition-driven ones. Intuition's great to create experiments, to then drive insight. But I will admit, I have had a bad habit in the past of making some intuition-led engineering engineering decisions. Sometimes I've been right, which only led me further down the path. Most of the time, I've been wrong. Remember, we were doing an optimization exercise for one customer up in Canada who was having a bit of a time with a real-time data feed system. And I had 4 guesses. Like, I think this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong, and this is wrong. The first 2, we went through, we did an experiment. Turns out, we tripled the speed of the system. We get to the 3rd one, we go and we implement it. We actually made it, like, 50% slower. Again, intuition led us to the creation of experiments, and we validated with data. And I figured, being 75% right was actually pretty good. So, when we think about characterizing insight, what am I doing with it? Am I informing or am I acting? Dashboard or report versus trigger? Workflow. What kind of question? Do I know the question that I'm asking? Building a dashboard is, I know the question, and I'm always asking it over a set of data. Versus, am I doing a diagnostics? Am I exploring? Am I looking for new patterns? Am I looking for the questions I don't know to ask yet? This is where we hear a lot about big data. This is where we hear a lot about machine learning. It's going in and figuring out the questions we don't know to ask yet. Momentum and window. How much data do I need in order to gain insight? If I'm building a KPI that's month over month kind of growth rates and usage rates, I need to look at a month's worth of data. But I'm not going to change that very quickly. There's a lot of momentum question. Whereas, is there a spike in my application queue? Is my latency trending up for a particular service call? I might think in terms of seconds or minutes of data, very low momentum, very quickly changing. So how much do I need to capture? Is it global versus local data? And finally, that's the last piece. How much do I need? If I'm trying to make a decision of, is this downstream service healthy from my perspective, I only need local data, local observation. If I'm going, how many users do I have in my entire service? I need global, or at least I need data from multiple machines, multiple instances, which means I need to bring it all together in order to ask the question. Local computation is easier than global. Global is more complete.
So one of the unnamed services in Microsoft is using Strategy because it's very, very big, where they have a help level of instrumentation. And then when they see a problem, they kind of zone it, isolate it, and then they increase the logging to see what's going on. They kind of take a weak signal of unhappiness or unhealthiness, and then they increase the logging. What's your view on those kind of things?
So
very
to
sophisticated service, right?
So to repeat for the recording, there are services within Microsoft that have a low fidelity continuous sample, and when they detect an issue, a trend, something going on, they dial up the diagnostics window, capture much richer data for analytics. This is a very advanced
for a given section
of the system, not globally, but within a local boundary. This is a really great pattern. It also requires you to take many steps down the path in order to build the muscles and build the infrastructure in order to be able to do this successfully. There are a couple other patterns where I've seen services, they capture huge amounts of data into an in-memory ring buffer. And then when they detect an issue, they dump the last 30 seconds or the last 2 minutes of data. Because their particular workflow is, we only detect issues after they've happened. So we need, you know, a minute or 2 minutes of historical data. And putting it in a circular buffer in memory is relatively cheap versus flushing everything on a disk. So there are tiers of capability, there are tiers of maturity. The good news is you can, especially for the normal run of systems, you can get 80 to 90% of what you need through some very simple techniques. It's when you get into the million plus user scale systems and services where you have to start applying some of these richer capabilities. Luckily, they all layer on top of each other. Again, as with kind of designing for scale, we start simple and then we get a little bit more rich and a little bit more robust, either as the projected business demand or the actual business demand. But if you're starting off saying, I'm designing a Microsoft platform service with a million users, this stuff has to happen from the beginning. If this is a, listen, I'm helping one of my customers expose a new service where they may be successful, a little bit on, we'll talk about, all right, we're going to start with a third-party monitoring service that'll do most everything we need with a minimal dev cost and time to market. And we may outgrow that service as we go and then start to bake in more custom experiences. In terms of workflow detection, when I get to that inform and act, this is really what it triggers. Is there a problem? Or, hey, is there something funny going on? How do I dig into it? How bad was it? What was the impact on the user? Why is there a problem? What's the root cause? How do I fix it? If I'm working with a 6-second SLA system, this has to be automated, at least partially. I may route around the problem and then fix the root cause in the next service release, but that, again, level of sophistication versus the amount, you know, the SLA that I'm providing. And finally, verification, regression analysis. Is the problem actually gone, or did it just go away because my users went away? So let's talk about capturing insight, just in a very discrete kind of way. I keep coming back to this, and there's a reason, because this one has bit me. This has bit internal services, this has bit external services. If you're going to call out to something outside of your process boundary, you've got to have the application context. Where did it come from? You've got to have your host context. What was I calling from? What was I doing? What instance was I on? Timing information. When did I start? When did I stop? How long did it take? These can be multiple events you chain together. It can be a single discrete. And for the kind of, as we talk about going down that road and building in more maturity and more sophistication, if you're developing a service that other people call, you really want to have every single thing you do tied to an activity identifier that flows around. This is a little tricky to do right now. It can be a lot of work. It may not be kind of, the ROI may not be there, but leave the door open for it. Because otherwise, when a customer calls up and said, listen, this API call failed, here's the tracing ID I got. Well, first of all, if the call is, hey, my API failed, and this is 1 out of 100,000 calls, you may be like, well, identifying this will be tricky. Time to put our psychic debugging hats on and go to work. If you're building a service where you do need to be able to get down to that level of granularity, you've got to return some form of identifier back to the upstream caller, whether that's a web page that gets rendered or a REST API that gets called. And if that's not tied to a bunch of activities within your telemetry logs, you're kind of stuck. We'll talk about that more in the unplugged section. But also, I need to consolidate these logs to a central system and a central dashboard for health monitoring. because if it's on 1,000 machines, it's not doing me any good until I bring it together and start asking questions. All right, so let's talk about that piece of code that we saw earlier and dig a little bit into some of the interesting things. This was just a cut and paste. It wasn't the exact piece, but it was a similar one. So we have delegates, baked-in delegates that are just handling all this wrapping for us. I, as a developer, basically say, this is my SQL app. Go forth and do interesting things. I, as a developer, have not explicitly timed all my SQL activity. My basic libraries are doing it for me. This is great because developers are lazy. Don't make them think. I count myself among them. Contextual errors. Who's done an exception.toString? I have. I'm totally guilty. I have done this. I will probably continue to do it in the future. I will eventually break this bad habit. The reason this is a bad habit is it used to be that the exception was just an exception. I'd get an argument exception, an invalid operation exception. I'd call toString, and I'd get everything. But a couple of things have started to happen. We have, anytime you're using tasks, you get an aggregate exception that bundles up all the things that happened in that asynchronous activity and delivers it to you in a container. If you don't unroll that aggregate exception, you may simply get a message that says two errors occurred. Back to psychic debugging. Probably best to avoid that. And making developers do the right thing every single time with their exceptions, there's no business value in that. So what you want is a logging facade that takes the exception directly as an object. It doesn't need to be unrolled manually. It gets unrolled by policy by the logging object. Most logging facades just take a string. You don't want that. You want a logging interface that takes exceptions as an object. That way, you can always evolve that policy independent from the rest of your code. Finally, you want an asynchronous logging library. Just like I beat and beat and beat on, you want asynchronous communication, you must have an asynchronous logging library. Because all of the async communication in the world does not help you if your logging library makes a synchronous call to a database. That was not a randomly chosen anecdote in any way, shape, or form. I have seen logging frameworks with synchronous calls to external systems bring down services. It must be async. Is anyone using Log4Net? Good. Okay, stop. Don't use it. Log4Net used to be kind of the gold standard. I like it. It's a great library, very commonly used. The problem is it has no easy way to do asynchronous logging. All of its targets are synchronous. So if you hit one slowdown, for example, if you have a lot of log writes to a single file, which happens under load, everybody backs up. I recommend either the use of something like Nlog, which has easy async targets, or the use of some of the ETW-based providers. They've been a little accessible to date, but there's some new stuff coming relatively soon, including some new stuff from PMP that'll actually make it accessible.
I think, Mark, it would be good if you go into the fire and forget, just making sure that it's not just asynchronous, it's fire and forget. Mm-hmm. I think you're making that comment on the slide, you haven't said it. So
yes, the other thing is not just the async, but it's the getting this message reliably to the destination is somebody else's problem. Essentially, not just async, call, and complete. Async is actually probably a bad term. What I actually want is I want to throw this into a queue and never see it again and let someone else extract the data from a queue. So event tracing for Windows works this way. I give you a message, it puts it into a kernel buffer, and I don't have to worry about it. It's a full separation between producer and consumer. Good luck.
Async void, not async task.
That is a fantastic way. Async void instead of async task. I will steal great comments where I can get them from the audience for the purpose of the recording. So that's it. That's really a key one. As long as you have a logging interface that subscribes to the first two, and then a logging implementation that it subscribes to the third one, you can log a fairly large amount of data, but not drop the inline performance of your application.
So in this example, are you not doing activity identification tracking?
In this particular example, I am. In this particular example, I'm not actually doing full activity tracing. This is an older sample, because until we learned, we don't have good activity tracing here. We need to update our sample and update our reference. So yes, this is definitely an example of do what I'm telling you to do, not what I have done and haven't yet updated.
I'm just asking because simplistically, are you taking that as a parameter on the method, or is there a more sophisticated way to do that rather than have every
To repeat the question, am I doing it, taking it as a parameter, or is there a more sophisticated way to pull it in? As of today, and if we do this, have this again in 6 months, I will absolutely have a different answer that I can't talk about yet. You have to pass it explicitly. So whether you bake it into your HTTP headers, you pass it as a task context object, you have to do it explicitly. There are some fairly advanced items out there, and certainly the MSDN articles, on how to do it implicitly. But that requires a lot of code judo. We have this conversation a few months down the road. I'll be able to talk about how magic happens and it just works. The key thing is having your logging experiences set up to be able to accept that as we improve the ways to collect this data implicitly. Used to be we do it from thread contexts, dispatch-based world of tasks. That doesn't work anymore. All right, let's talk about bringing down a production system with logging. This is a screenshot from a production application using Log4Net. This was captured by the AppDynamics monitoring engine, which we'll talk about a little bit later, and it shows the stack of a 2-second delay in a service API with a 50 millisecond SLA. This does not leave the process boundary. There is no blocking I/O call to another service here. Instead, what is happening, and I apologize if it's a little hard to see at the back, at the very bottom of the call stack, Microsoft.win32.win32 native set file pointer win32. This strangely named API call is basically saying, I am blocking on my ability to acquire a mutex on a file to a specific point, basically to grab the tail pointer for the file. This is a live lock. I've got a huge number of synchronous operations pushing down to the same file concurrently, all competing for the tail pointer and blocking. Log4Net, synchronous file appender, writing to a local resource. If you were to point the same library at a remote resource like a database, this gets 10 times or 100 times. If this was the fire and forget, this what might block in the background, but you wouldn't care. More importantly, the logging library would be able to batch, would be able to be chunky, not chatty. Take 10 or 15 log records and write them out in sequence. If you're doing, that's the other thing about doing synchronous. You're not letting the components, you're not letting the frameworks do the right thing or do more optimal things. So yeah, this was a 4-hour outage triggered by this. And again, because of the way they'd written their code, there was no easy mediation here. I keep coming back to you've got to have an abstract interface for logging that you can plug other experiences into. In this particular case, Log4Net was being used directly. So to rip it out, they have two options. They either have to write an asynchronous target for Log4Net, which means rewriting half of the library, and then testing it and rolling it into production, or they'd have to go through and rip out all the Log4Net code and replace it with something else, as opposed to I'm just going to change the implementation, test it, and then roll it into production. I have another customer that has 37,000 lines of hard-coded trace source. They want to go to structured logging with event tracing for Windows. It's going to cost them a lot of money to get there. And by a lot, I mean a very large amount of time and money. Question?
If you have multiple levels or you have categories of logs, one of the things that's quite useful to do is to not pass straight parameters, you pass a lambda. So for instance, if you've got like a burst and debug and warning, then when you change the log level, the string.format doesn't get executed for all the stuff which you're
going on. So the statement was, when you're logging facade, if you employ a lambda function, a closure essentially, you can do deferred execution. You cannot invoke a potentially expensive string format operation if your log level is not set. So there's a couple of different approaches you can take to basically not paying the cost of formatting a string or doing another expensive operation if you don't intend to log. A lambda is one excellent one. The other one is passing a params object and checking the log level before invoking string format. And I'll show both examples in a second. I tend to actually have both in my log level because some developers prefer a lambda passing. Some prefer just a kind of a native unstructured. And I'm still looking for the data on what is the actual impact of that number of closures in a high-scale system. I don't know where it lands.
It's a little messy syntactically.
Yeah, I like simple syntactically. I'm kind of lazy. I just want stuff that looks pretty. So let's talk about some options. All of these things do slightly different experiences. Who's used Windows Azure Diagnostics? How'd that work out? So Windows Azure Diagnostics is not bad baseline platform, but its default configuration doesn't scale at all. And we'll get into why, and I can show a slightly different configuration of Windows Azure Diagnostics that scales to 1,000 instances. But you can't accept the defaults. The defaults are for the general case. Sometimes we move past the general case. Doesn't mean it's bad technology, just means we need to use it slightly separately. The challenge is there's not a rich tooling experience based around this. It's not something I can just drop and go and get a really kind of that really great diagnostic, that really great dashboard, that really great insight. So we have some really phenomenal partners that are available from the Azure store, like New Relic and AppDynamics and Opstera, that provide me relatively turnkey logging and management experiences. So let's talk about Opstera directly. Opstera is based on top of Windows Azure Diagnostics, so it's never any better than the data stream. My recommendation, based on production experiences, is Metrics Hub, especially if you're looking for a lot of auto-scaling capability, one of our great Techstar partners, AppDynamics or New Relic. Most of the screenshots that I will have shown are from AppDynamics. Okay, so let's talk about Windows Azure Diagnostics, just to set the baseline and help you understand when you want to use it and when you don't. So starting off, this is the Azure Platform Agent. This is not the one that the Azure Fabric uses to manage. This is the one that gets loaded along with your web roles and your worker roles. It captures performance counters and other structured data. It captured system diagnostics traces, either driven by code or XML configuration. I tend to prefer XML config. And it's partially dynamic, that if you post a config update to a specially named blob store, it'll pick it up and kind of change the configuration on the fly. So what it does is it gathers data and writes in the local event tracing for Windows buffers. So it's hideously efficient from a local resource utilization perspective. It also gathers IIS log files and stages them in the blob storage. So based on our experiences and our discussions around table scalability, and the little hint that perf counters are written in to a partition based around the current minute timestamp, who sees the giant scalability bottleneck in this plan? Or is it just a long day and you all are like, come on, give me the answer, don't make me talk? So remember we had an absolute cap on the number of operations that could happen in a single partition at any given point in time? If you get about more than 16 or so instances, it's probably 64 now since tables got more robust. Basically what you do is you have a write bottleneck, a hot spot on the performance counter table partition. And because things are done in strict first in, first out order, once I back up, there's no priority queuing. Any new entries that got bottlenecked don't get written in. This does not scale very well. The practical advice I have is that once you're running above 16 instances, you can really only capture data about every 5 minutes. And that is very painful if you're running a low SLA system. A really high SLA system with really low tolerances. All right, so let's get in and talk a little bit about instrumenting with WAD. By default, everything goes through the same channels. This does not work. There's no separation of important and less important. So really what we want to do is we want to have chunky logging. We want to be able to capture lots of stuff, but not pay the cost of post to get into table storage. We want to be able to capture tracing for various levels and just split it out. We want to go, let's take important things by category and priority, put them in table storage, and things that are not as interesting, let's just drop them in blobs. Now, one of the really cool capabilities of WAD that I actually do recommend you use is basically a file watcher. It says, look in this directory, and if you see something, put it in blob storage. Store and forward, you didn't have to write it, you didn't have to maintain it, very reliable. Less code, faster time to market. So what we can do is we can set up and log our logging library of choice to dump archive files out in a specific managed directory, grab them, and then shovel them up into blob storage. And I've done this on some pretty large-scale implementations. So pretty very similar things, only we split stuff so that Less important events still go to table storage. Sorry, more important events go to table storage. Less important events go to a local file and then get batched, stored, and forwarded into blob storage. And blob storage is, in this world, is good up to about 8,000 or 9,000 instances before it starts to bottleneck. And I would say if you're running at that scale, we have a lot of stuff to talk about, and that's the least of your problems because you are running some serious scale systems.
So, doesn't that expose you to the issue that you're putting on a local storage, if you've done something that takes out the VM, mm-hmm. you're going to lose that at the time that you really need it.
Yeah. So the question is, what happens if I did something and I lost the VM? I've lost the message. You're always having this problem of, if you're asynchronous, what you're doing is you're not slowing down the train. So, but even if you're going fully synchronous, something bad happens. And there's a time window between when I can get that to durable storage and when I can't. If I elevate that to top priority and do it immediately, I've shrunk the time window, but I haven't made it disappear. So really, it's the machine could drop at any time. I could have another piece of code that does something very strange and takes down the app domain. There is the possibility of losing data. This is inherently lossy. You're never going to have complete visibility into telemetry. It's physically impossible. You can have maximal information where you get collect as much as is practical, but you're never going to have anything. But the flip side of that is we make far more critical decisions based on incomplete information every single day. Has anyone ever crossed the street? Of course, we all have. What do? I'm going to give a little bit of nod to our UK friends. You look right, and then you look left, and then you go. So what you are doing is you are working off delayed information with two partial views, and you're putting your life on the basis of that information. And speaking for myself, that's worked out pretty well because I'm still standing here. So it's perfectly acceptable to make decisions with partial information, but you have to know how much information do I need in order to make good decisions, and how much is not enough. Okay. And having 80% information is enormously better than having 0% information. So we got about 15 minutes. I'm actually going to skip. I'll come back to this one. But I just want to talk a little bit about some of the options available. Because starting off for most of your customers, my recommendation is not to use Windows Azure Diagnostics, is not to use the developer-centric tooling, is but to use a canned service that gets you up and running quickly with very rich experiences. It's worth paying for. Okay. So let's talk about System Center, very briefly. System Center is a great product. It does lots of interesting things. It is not a cloud management service. System Center works really well when I want to do a hybrid management, when I have a lot of stuff on-premise and some stuff in the cloud. The key thing to remember about System Center and its Azure Management Pack is it uses the Windows Azure Diagnostics data store. So it can never be better than Windows Azure Diagnostics. We already talked about where that kind of breaks down. This is just something to keep in mind if you already have System Center and you already have investments there, or your customers do, and they want to extend those a little bit. Just be aware, the limit of this is the limit of Windows Azure Diagnostics. Metrics Hub. So this new startup on Azure. These guys are primarily focused around auto-scaling, but they have a lot of rich insight. They're based on Windows Azure Diagnostics, don't do that, or by custom instrumentation with an agent. Again, if you're more leaning towards being able to optimize your deployment, if you have customers that are very cost sensitive and want to be able to ramp their loads up and down, has anyone used the PMP autoscale block? A couple hands. It's the Wasabi. This is an implementation of a service, though the algorithms these guys use are a little bit more sophisticated. And they have a really neat feature where you can monitor your service for a couple of weeks, and they'll tell you, here's what we would have done. Does this look right? And here's how much we would have saved you. Especially if you have kind of price-sensitive or cost-sensitive or optimization-sensitive customers, this is a really interesting one to look at. So AppDynamics. These guys, you get what you pay for. It's not hideously cheap, but it is really, really powerful. They will do a couple of things. They hook into the profiling API. So I'll actually show you live stack traces, and they'll also instrument cross-service dependencies. You don't have to do anything. There is, of course, a scalability limit here. I'm not sure exactly where it is. Most folks will probably not hit it on their own projects. And if the customer has the appetite to pay for this, or if you're running a kind of a relatively small number of servers, this is a fantastic service. You drop their agent in place. It just hooks into all your stuff. pulls your HTTP connections, pulls your WCF, pulls your ADO.NET, and then builds a communication graph and tells you when stuff starts going out of whack. It also starts analyzing the call stacks. So if you start seeing this service slowing down, you can drill into the aggregate call stack and go, hey, it's this line of code. Just like we saw earlier with the set file pointer, that was with a vanilla AppDynamics installation. Highly recommended if the customer is, you know, incented to pay for it. Most enterprise customers, this is a no-brainer. For startups or folks who are kind of a little operationally sensitive, this can be a little tricky. Again, you guys know your customers better than I do.
So what is the performance hit of having these things in your application?
So the performance hit for AppDynamics is about 5 to 6%. So basically you'll burn about an extra 5 or 6% CPU, memory, and a bit of network. That's because they're hooking the profiling API, which is a little expensive. We expect to see kind of these APMs, the application performance monitors, switch to using ETW in future. Again, this, I'm not going to go too much into futureware, but again, if we had this conversation a year, I expect that number to be 1 to 2%. Either way, it's a business discussion around ROI. Will you pay an extra 5% in terms of the number of instances, which is, you know, maybe an extra $100 a month in terms of deployed VMs for visibility? Or do we go back to playing blindfolded Frogger? Again, in a world where it's not, hey, I need to get every single ounce of performance out of this one giant machine, it's, oh, okay, I need to have an instance a month earlier. All right, New Relic. Again, I really like these guys. They have a great experience. They also, they do, all these folks have a bit of an overlap. They all do some of the things that other folks do, but they tend to have sweet spots. AppDynamics is fantastic from what is my service doing, what is it connecting with. New Relic is also really good for where are my users coming from and what are they doing. So I'll get my geographic maps, I'll get my heat maps, I'll get my KPIs, but I'll also get my live diagnostics about how much memory am I using, how much CPU am I using, how much thread, what's my thread pool pressure. And the good thing is, again, this is hooking the profiling API. I don't have to have my developers spend time baking this stuff in. I won't get my discrete events, but I will get all my ambient telemetry. I'll know my calls, I'll know my activities. And again, in terms of time to market, you can't beat these two solutions. It's a little bit of config, drop the agent in, and out you go. I would do a live demo, but my laptop's misbehaving the last couple of days, so I didn't want to actually publish any cloud services. It's due for either a wipe or get run over by my car by accident. About collect, we talked about analyze, but we also talked about consume. And one of the things is acting. We talked about email as a third-party service, but notifications are also a really interesting third-party service. Anybody use PagerDuty before? These guys, this is a phenomenal service. Basically, you say is when something happens, I would like to burst out notifications. I don't know if pagers actually exist anymore. I'm sure you could buy one on eBay. But I want to send out an SMS, I want to fire an email, I want to have a workflow that actually sends a voicemail to someone's phone reading out an error message. It's an API call. Building this capability in your own application would be hideously expensive versus, oh, I don't know, $18 a month for premium experiences. That seems like a really nice trade-off in terms of service composition versus building it myself. And these guys happen to hook in with AppDynamics, hook in with New Relic, and really kind of give a glimpse into the future world of highly compositional services that are very interoperable and very composable in an open environment. So if you have users that need to get notifications, whether it's site availability, users doing interesting things, really great service, just a bunch of REST calls. And for the for those couple of those monitoring services I mentioned, it's just click, configure PagerDuty, send these alerts, and you're done. Pretty neat. I'm a big fan. All right. That's the demo I'm not going to do because of my misbehaving laptop. I'll take 5 minutes, talk a little bit about some of the configuration stuff. Again, I only want to crack that door open a little bit because it could be an entire day, and I would not be the one to teach it. I believe in this stuff a lot. It's just not where I spend a lot of time. Getting your ALM right is it's important when you're kind of building out a box product. Or a box set of box experiences, when you're doing cloud services, this is where most people fall apart. This is where most people have their really unfortunate learning experience. Microsoft included, we are not immune to this. Because nothing will save me in my test environments from pushing out a bad build. Nothing will save me from Oh, I don't know. Oh, doing this. To me, the configuration screen for an Azure service is the single most terrifying feature we have. I understand its importance, it's got a place, but this is scary. The fact that I can go in and live edit configuration, which is then pushed out across the entire service, I don't know what the formal term is, but this gives me the heebie-jeebies. Because this is a loaded shotgun pointed at your foot. This is great for dev, it's great for quick, you know, kind of quick changes, but once you get into a production scale system, unless every configuration update is part of a version scripting environment with an audit trail and validation, this will bring down services. And in fact, when I was referring to earlier, when you dig into the RCAs, you almost always find something like this. Someone pushed a bad config. Someone pointed the test harness at the production database, and all of a sudden I have 32 million invalid users and my reports look a little strange, and the SEC is not happy with me. Folks familiar with VIP swapping? I'm just getting 1 second. So who's used to do kind of the stand up a service, do the VIP swap? Yeah. So there's an interesting problem with VIP swaps. Is I'm going to push up my configuration, which is the test config, and the production config, but then I can't swap them because I'm not working against the right data stores. So I'll push up a prod config and a prod config, and I want to test this one on the background. And now it's writing a bunch of test data into the production account. There's ways around that. This is generally why we go to prefer an in-place upgrade. The other reason VIP swaps can be a little dangerous is VIP swaps are atomic. If I have 5 instances, that's pretty easy. If I have 800 and 800, now all of a sudden, I need to successfully deploy all 800 VMs, and if one of them fails or is a little cranky, I can't do a VIP swap. System won't let me. So, in general, I would avoid VIP swaps. I would do in-place upgrades. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there.
Can this be automated?
Yep. So the question is, can this be automated? Yes. Every single thing you see on the Azure portal is an API call. This is basically an update to the configuration settings. You can do it from C#. You can do it from a PowerShell commandlet. You can even do it from a REST API if you want to bake in all this stuff. So the question is around what's the security. So here's where we have a bit of the current stage of growth for the platform. To be able to access management, to basically have rights to access a management API in Azure, you need to have the appropriate client certificate. But right now, today, client certificates are global admin rights per subscription, meaning that if I have the management certificate, I can do anything. So some of the more robust ALM processes, as I've seen, never give end users direct access. They proxy it through some system that provides ACLs. No doubt, as the platform evolves, we will have more of that. But right now, a management certificate is a global wrecking ball. You can use it for good, or you can use it for, oh, I didn't mean to do that. Yes, but once someone has a certificate, if they can do anything, they can do everything. And this is one of the other reasons why one global subscription for an entire company is fairly dangerous. Had a conversation with a customer last week who wanted to roll out 181 applications under one subscription. Mark remembers this discussion. And we're kind of looking at him going, I do not want to do that. Mostly because you want to insulate these applications from each other. Because right now, one fat finger of script could blow everything away. Because you have no isolation between your deployment environments. And since the subscription is, again, you don't want a million of them. Because it is a billing entity as well as a management entity. But there's a happy medium ground. But yes, this is absolutely scriptable. And some of the stuff, and again, I don't have a lot of really kind of great practices or war stories to tell about this, but it's starting to treat the packages and the config as atomic sets of versioned entities using something like TFS or Git. So that your I need to roll back is go to the repository where everything was stored, grab V-1, pull it out, and push it up. Again, that requires building up those ALM muscles. That requires investment in DevOps. Folks, have there been any of your customers working along a DevOps model? Developers carrying pagers again? Couple folks. As much as I hate carrying a pager, and as I've done it before, one thing that customers subscribing to a DevOps model forces is, in general, devs hate writing instrumentation. They hate making things debuggable because they want to work on cool new features, and I don't blame them. That's where business value comes from directly. Once folks get in a world of, I wrote the code, I support it, and I carry the pager, you start to see this really interesting cultural shift of, I'm going to do everything in my power to make these systems self-healing and as diagnosable in as small a time as possible. Because when I get called at 3 in the morning for a site outage, I want to resolve it before I even wake up and then go back to sleep. If you have dev and operations fully independent with a big wall in the middle, this behavior tends not to happen very quickly. So it's an awkward change. We're actually going through it ourselves. But if you have customers that are embarking on that ISV to CSV journey, having them investigate the DevOps culture and kind of some of the beneficial and not so beneficial side effects may be very interesting. That's one of those cultural aspects of this kind of shift to cloud services as opposed to pure technical. Okay, one last point on services. We want global simultaneous production rollouts all over the world of code. Are you sure? Because what you're saying here is, I want my mistakes to be globally available instantly. This is essentially what it means. We have a number of customers saying, we want atomic updates globally. I'm like, probably not. I think what you're saying is you want it to streamline the ability to do staged rollouts over multiple data centers in a coordinated fashion, which is just a little bit different from what you actually asked for. The folks who have been down this before are like, no. We want to carefully stage stuff out. And some of the more spectacular failures that you see from the big vendors have been related to this, of pushing out something where we didn't catch a mistake quickly enough, we or other vendors, pushing it out broadly and then going, ooh, there's a bug there, and then having to roll it all back. Production rollouts. Since there's no such thing as an atomic global consistency in a code push, during an update, you're always supporting version N and version N plus 1. So when you're thinking about interfaces, when you're thinking about services, it requires you to be compatible for at least two versions. Which means when you're looking at your REST interfaces, if you're deprecating one, you're going to want to leave it around for a while. If you're adding new ones, you want those interfaces to be additive. So that I can add new ones without breaking the old ones, because during any upgrade process, I will have at least two copies simultaneously in production, especially if I'm doing a nice, careful, phased rollout that could take several hours. There is no magical boom. I have everything new in production. Even if I'm doing a VIP swap, I will still have some clients connecting to A and some clients connecting to B based on when I have a balancer.
And depending on your service and their dependencies, you may have client A calling B if they're talking to service B.
Absolutely. To repeat, depending on the interdependencies, client N can be hitting service N plus 1. Client N plus 1 can be hitting service N. This is one of the reasons I like very simple facades based on REST standards that don't fluctuate too much or are at least additive. That way, I can isolate the logic that actually implements the call separate from the facade and be able to handle versioning and mediation back there. Kind of one other item. Don't ever bake the actual business logic into the command handler. This is very common in WCF services, where basically my ability to respond is basically the logic's right there in the service handler. Not saying you guys do it. I'm sure you know better. I'm sure you're like a little more decoupled. But I've seen it in a lot of customer code. That way, when they want to change transports, they want to change facades, they want to add web API, things are locked together. Again, just another instance of that, those kind of abstractions. There is no problem in computer science that cannot be solved with another layer of abstraction other than too many layers of abstraction. I steal from the best. Okay. Again, just quick recap on what we're discussing. Script your deployments. Don't use the Visual Studio tooling. It's there for dev experiences. It's not what you want in production ops. You are going to want your continuous integration server, phasing out to your golden build, phasing to a version package, and then rolling out. All of this is relatively easily scriptable. There's a little bit of work up front, but it pays for avoiding the outages that you didn't know about because you didn't make them. Configuration changes are a production update. Do not live edit config in production. There will be surprises.
The way the people in this STB group are calling this, treat configuration as code. Version it, ALM it, all that other stuff. But do not just have a text file, XML file, and have it fly around.
Yeah, to read for the recording, configuration is code. Treat it accordingly. And your configuration and your code package are tightly tied together. Your code is completely dependent on the right configuration. If I can't find my storage accounts, I can't log into my storage accounts, I can't really do anything useful. And put your configuration in the cloud service package, not in your web config and your app config. Those cannot be changed at runtime in any sensible way. Okay, that actually brought us to the end, but I'm happy to show some kind of some more code. Do a quick recap, then we'll come off mic. So we talked about there are different approaches for instrumentation and monitoring. In general, you're going to want to go and get a canned solution for most applications. You may outgrow them, but it's not a bad place to start. And it's usually the best place to start because people will start seeing things and having insight into parts of the application they never would have had before. Don't be afraid to log lots of things. Just be careful about how you do it. Asynchronous, loosely coupled, still applies. Configuration and change management are the Achilles heel of all services. It's worth the investment. Configuration code, always have that rollback strategy. Otherwise, your rollback strategy will be recreating things on the fly under pressure while the system's on fire. I much prefer just running another script and then upgrading to V-1. And again, if I don't know what's happening, it's just as well it wasn't, because the system will likely be on fire while I'm feeling very good about the world. So, yep.
What is like a real life scenario? I got 10 devs or X number of devs and I'm building a system. Mm-hmm. Where does my dev environment live? Is that on a separate subscription? Where does my test environment live? Is that on
Okay, great question. So the question is, what does a real environment look like in terms of ALM and separation by subscription? Most customers I've seen for an intact feature group or an intact service group have a dev subscription, a test subscription, and a prod subscription. Maybe a couple of prod subscriptions, depending on the types of services they're running. And they'll go from my CI server will publish into my dev subscription, do some relatively small testing. I'll then promote into my test subscription, and I might do I'll do my full integration tests, I might do a bit of load testing, and then I promote the code base iteratively into my production subscription. And I keep those nice and separate. That way I don't have things mixing up. And since I have isolated credentials for each, I don't have my test deployment accidentally blowing away production.
Right. The certificate problem.
Yeah. And if all of this is automated, then the devs don't have the keys to the production site. They basically say, hey, validation system, here's my package, here's my code, please take this, do your checks, roll it through, and now we have the operations staff, who might also be developers, but have a separate set of workflows and a separate set of tools. This does impede agility. This enforces rigor. You have to go through a process. And most devs, myself being one of them, hate process. The challenge with live site services is once you start going around that process, you start entering the world of, I don't know what version's out there. I don't know what it's doing. Great when you're getting started, but once you have users and you have an SLA, this gets awkward to say the least. So thank you very much for listening to me blather on for almost 8 hours now. And hope you enjoyed the session.
Additional videos in this series can be found on Channel 9 at http://channel9.msdn.com/series/failsafe. In addition, Microsoft Services and the Azure Customer Advisory Team have produced white papers and guidance on these subjects. You can find these on the Azure Architecture Center at http://www.windowsazure.com/en-us/develop/net/architecture.